This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, a story of the life struggles of two peoples in Newfoundland in the 19th century. Michael Crummy's novel, River Thieves, is set early in the 19th century at a time that saw the extinction of the island's aboriginal people, the Beothuk, or Red Indians. Michael Crummy is a poet and short story writer. River Thieves is his first novel. It was published to great acclaim last year in Canada. The book is now available in the U.S. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. River Thieves tells a story of a tenuous, sometimes violent relationship between the people sharing the land. The territory's governor wishes for friendly contact with the Indians, and a group of men, led by Lieutenant David Buchan and John Peyton Jr., son of a successful Newfoundland trapper, set out to find the Beothuk. Contact is made, but the mission ends badly, with two Marines in the party murdered and beheaded. The novel is also about the relationships in the Peyton household. There is the patriarch, John Peyton Sr., his son, and Cassie. Cassie is an independent woman, 6 years older than the younger Peyton, who came to live with the father and son to keep house and tutor young Peyton. Listeners, you can join the conversation with a telephone call. Your questions and comments are invited. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Michael Crummy is a native of Newfoundland. He grew up in mining towns in Newfoundland and Labrador. In 1987, he graduated from Memorial University in St. John's with a degree in English. It was there that he began writing poetry. Listeners, your calls are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Michael Crummy, good afternoon. Welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Sure, my pleasure. You were born in a mining community called,
that's right,
called Buchans?
Well, called Buchans.
Buchans, okay.
Yep.
Thank you. And was there a Lieutenant Buchan, and was Buchans and Buchan Island named for him?
They were, actually. David Buchan is an historical figure. And Red Indian Lake, where a number of the central events in the novel take place, is about 5 minutes from my hometown of Buchans. Which is why I think the community was named after him.
And what is Buchans like?
Well, it's very different now than when I grew up there. It's pretty much the geographical center of the island of Newfoundland, and the interior of Newfoundland is still pretty much uninhabited. Almost all of the communities in the province are on the coastline because fishing is what brought people here.
Hmm.
Buchans was set up in the interior after they found the minerals, and that is really its only reason to exist. And the mine is closed now. It closed about 20 years ago. When I was about 14, we actually left Buchans because my father was laid off from his job at the mine, and he looked for work elsewhere.
Yeah.
So when I guess I was born at the tail end of its heyday. So it's about 2,500 people in company houses at the end of a dead-end road. And it was a very active community. Because it was a company town, there were a lot more amenities there than just about any other town in the province that size. So there was a hockey rink and an outdoor swimming pool and tennis courts. And, of course, I watched all of those things close down.
Mm.
And now there are still, I think there are still probably several hundred people living there, mostly people who've retired there, because there is no industry in that town at all, and there isn't even any through traffic. You know, it's a dead-end road, so you don't go through there unless you're going there for a specific reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a sad place now, I find, to go back to.
Oh, it's That's too bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Newfoundland, though, sounds just like a wonderfully beautiful place.
It is in a very rugged kind of... it's in some places it's so ugly it's beautiful, if that makes any sense. It's rocks and scrubland in a lot of places, and very bare and barren, but in a way that is, I find anyway, spectacularly beautiful. And in other places, of course, on the West Coast especially, there are mountains and fjords, and it's a completely different world almost from the rest of the island, and strikingly beautiful out there.
Mm.
Yeah,
I imagine that in to some extent, to maybe a, perhaps a great extent, the island hasn't changed, isn't much changed today, as you know, from where when the time. Boy, I'm having a hard time here. I talk for a living. Don't you believe it? It hasn't changed much from the 19th century, the 17th century, in terms of the feel of the place.
Yeah,
on the interior.
In terms of the physical landscape, it's much the same. A little more populated, but still very sparsely. I think there are only about 500,000 people on the island, and it's a huge tract of land, so most of it is uninhabited. And it's, I mean, I think the landscape was one of the things that I wanted in the novel, and in some ways I think it's kind of like a major character in the book, and it's people's response to the difficulties of living in that landscape that, in some ways, defines who they are as people, and I think that's still true in some ways. Mm. And there's a real connection between Newfoundlanders, and always has been, it feels like, to the physical place that we live in. A real love for it, but there's also an element of fear there as well. And I think that was probably more true at the turn of the 19th century than now, that sense that even though the place provided your living, it could turn on you if you weren't careful, and that there were so many ways you could die in that landscape, you know. And I was very surprised. One of the things that surprised me about the time when I was reading the old diaries and journals, was how cold it was, because my experience of Newfoundland is that the winters are not that severe, and I since found out that there was actually a mini ice age at the time, mm-hmm. so all of North America was actually several degrees colder in the winter than it is today.
Yeah, there's a scene in the book where it's a very cold winter and the temperature is 25 below.
Right.
And you can imagine living in that in those conditions without central heating and having to go out and work.
Sure, or those treks they did down the river, taking the, like those expeditions down the Exploits River, which is about 80 miles inland in the middle of winter, because that was the easiest time to travel on the river when it was frozen. And to think that they like traveled in those circumstances when it would be minus 20, minus 25 with howling winds, and then it seemed like the weather was just completely unpredictable, because it could go from that to like rain, which would soak everybody's clothes and then go back to freezing again. And the most amazing thing to me about those expeditions that was that they were all volunteers, you know, that they voluntarily went down that river in those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And summers could be brutal as well, with mosquitoes swarming like drapery around you.
That's still true at certain times of the year. The out in the bush, the mosquitoes they can drive you just about insane, I would say. And it's traveling by car in Newfoundland is very dangerous because of the moose, who are driven out of the woods by mosquitoes and black flies. And the open ground of the highways is some relief to them. So they travel quite frequently on the roads. And there are a lot of moose car accidents as a result of that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Plenty of surprises for me as an American reader, I'll tell you.
Mm.
And one of them, I think, going back to the idea of the weather before we go on to some of the other wonderful things in the book, that traveling is easiest, or was easiest, when conditions were, it wasn't too cold, but yet the river was solidly frozen, so
right.
the waters were frozen so that you could travel across them.
Right. Well, the Exploits River is, I think, the largest river in the province. And most white settlers at the time of the novel had never gone very far down that river into the interior, because most of their living was on the coast, and also because it was known that that was a place inhabited by the Beothuk, by the indigenous inhabitants. And so they knew, for example, that the Indians had ways of getting around the rapids. There were Indian trails,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't know where those were. So traveling in the winter made it more possible for them to get down the river that way, to go against the current, because it was frozen solid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the book that takes place during the first expedition out to make contact, and the settlers come across quite an elaborate setup for slaughtering and processing caribou.
Mm-hmm.
The animals are herded into chutes. There's a building for slaughter and storage. I wonder, was that in fact a part of life for this group of Indians, the Beothuk?
It was, yeah. I tried to stick very closely to what we know about them in writing the book, in terms of how they lived, what kinds of activities they were involved in, and also in their interactions with the European settlers. Almost all of those in the book come directly from the historical record. And so they lived two separate lives, it seemed like. The summers, they broke up into very small groups of people and lived along the coastline and foraged for bird eggs, caught salmon and seals. And then in the winters, they moved inland, partly for the caribou migration across the Exploits River. And they had this incredibly elaborate way of herding the animals. Once they got into the river, and the caribou herd is, at the time, was a massive herd, thousands upon thousands of animals. And what they would do is, once the animals who were traveling west to east, once they got into the river, on the other side of the river, for miles, the Beothuk would have cut trees down across one another to create what they called deer fences, to keep them from getting back into the forest. So they would travel along the river until they reached an opening in these fences that the Beothuk had created. And that opening led back into a slaughtering yard, which was basically a large fenced area that the animals would be trapped in, and the Beothuk would shoot them from behind, shoot them with bows and arrows from behind the fences. Really an amazing feat of engineering,
mm-hmm.
I think. Really, yeah. And then though the caribou hunt was absolutely essential to their survival, and that's what got them through the winters. So they also had particular processes for curing the meat to keep it over the winter.
I found myself wondering, what would life have been like in Newfoundland had these two groups of people been able to get together and to be peaceful and friendly with one another?
Yeah.
They could have taught one another so much.
Well, yeah. There's part of me that feels that that's true, that that the extinction of the Beothuks was not a foregone conclusion, that if even one of these attempts to create friendly contact had gone differently, that they would still be with us today. But the other side of that, I think, is that if they had survived, they would certainly have been marginalized, just as all of the native groups in North America have been, and probably pushed onto a reserve somewhere. So I'm not sure there would have been that kind of cross-cultural contact and learning, even if they had survived. I don't know, I'm speculating, but basing that on what I see, for example, in the rest of Canada, where I think the indigenous groups in the rest of Canada are only now in the last couple of decades standing up as a political force to fight for their rights and have been marginalized for generation upon generation.
Yeah.
In Canada, there weren't the same sort of Indian wars that you hear about in the U.S. and in South America. But there was a very deliberate policy that I think was genocidal in its intent, and that was to get rid of Indians not by killing them, but by turning them into white people. And by that, I mean there was a residential schools program where Indian children were taken from their parents, kidnapped, basically, and put into residential schools where it was illegal to speak your own language,
mm-hmm.
where you were beaten for speaking your own language, and where you were taught to live and see the world as a white European Canadian would live and see the world. And the hope, I think, was that eventually there would be no Indian problem because there would be no Indians, even without having to resort to the kind of outright violence that we've seen in other places.
Mm.
A kinder, gentler genocide, I guess. And that was true right up until a generation ago. Like, there are people my age or just older than me who were taken from their parents, forcibly removed from their families, and put into these schools. So it would be nice to think that something different might have happened in Newfoundland, but I'm not convinced that that would have been true.
Yeah, well, there certainly is a lot of animosity on the part of the European settlers toward Indians.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean it was a fight for territory, really, and for political power, and it was carried out pretty ruthlessly just about everywhere in the Americas, from what I can see.
Mm. You mentioned how Native children were taken from their parents and educated or taken away to be indoctrinated, perhaps is a better word,
mm-hmm.
in reservation schools or in institutions. And here in this novel, River Thieves, we have a woman who was taken from her people.
Right.
Mary. She's called Mary.
Yep. She was named Mary by the settlers. Yeah. And that's all, that is an historical event. In that case, it's a very odd thing. In Newfoundland, there was, as far as I can tell, there was no established friendly contact between the Beothuk people and the European settlers in, to that point, almost probably 250 years of some kind of contact, intermittent contact. No one ever succeeded in establishing some kind of friendly interaction where there was some kind of real communication between the two groups. And one of the strategies that the English came up with, and it seems ridiculous now, to looking back at it, but their idea was, and they made a number of attempts at this, was to, I think their phrase was, lay hold of a Beothuk Indian, basically to kidnap somebody, to teach that person to speak English. And once they know how to speak English, convince them that they're friendly, that their intentions are friendly, and to use that person as an intermediary between the two groups. And there was actually a standing 150-pound reward offered by the governor to anyone who could facilitate that by bringing in a live Beothuk. And in the novel, the Paytons, John Payton Sr. and Jr., go down the river Exploits to the lake because earlier that year, a small group of Beothuk had stolen a boat from them that they'd just loaded with a season's worth of salmon. And although they recovered the boat and the salmon, there was quite a bit of damage done, and everything movable on the boat was stolen. So they went down hoping to recover some of the stolen material, but they also were hoping to kidnap a Beothuk person because they thought that the reward of 150 pounds would just about cover their losses. And as it turned out, they come upon Mary on the lake and take her, and her husband and another man attempt to intervene, and in the struggle that follows, her husband is killed. And then they bring Mary back down to their house on the coast of the island. And much of the novel after that event follows the playing out of that, the investigation into what happened on the lake, an investigation into who actually did the killing, and also follows Mary's relationships to John Peyton Jr. and to Cassie in the household. And when I was doing the research for the book, I was originally interested in writing about something different, but there was that particular event and those people in that household with Mary was what really caught and held my attention, because there was something appallingly intimate about it. This woman being kidnapped by these men who kill her husband in front of her, and then she lives with them for a number of months before she dies, and in fact becomes quite affectionate with John Peyton Jr. Like, there's a very strong emotional bond that grows between those two, and it was very interesting and somehow appalling to me that could happen. Mm. And I wanted to explore that somehow in the novel.
Yeah. Now, the Peytons were historical figures.
They were, yeah. They were trappers and fishermen on the northeast shore of Newfoundland. And John Sr. was a very successful trapper and fisherman. He owned quite a large tracts of land on the northeast shore. And that at that time, it was the northeast shore was largely uninhabited except for Beothix. And so white settlers could more or less move in and set up wherever they liked, which is what John Sr. did. And he is known and was known unapologetically as a great Indian killer, and was ruthless in his dealings with the Beothuk, pretty much shot at them on sight, and responded to any stealing by them by sending off party, or leading a party usually, and which most often led to some sort of bloodshed. Mm-hmm. And his son, in contrast, John Peyton Jr., was involved in almost all attempts to establish some kind of friendly contact with the Beothuk. And in many ways, I think that's where the novel started for me, just wondering about that difference between the two men and what would it have been like in a house where they spent much of their adult lives together. And in a lot of ways, I think the fictional stories that I came up with for the novel are an attempt to account for some of those differences between the two men.
Yeah, because the difference is quite remarkable.
It is, yeah. And we really don't know why. I mean, the amount of historical material we have about the two men is pretty slim. So I think really in those situations, fiction is the only way to try and deal with it in any way that feels satisfying. And I know that other people feel differently, that some people feel like that's messing with history in a way that's unfair to the people who lived it. And I understand that point of view. But for me personally, it was really, I didn't feel there was any other way to get inside that story without fictionalizing somehow.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It seems to me perfectly fair to write a work of fiction where you take some strings of history and weave them together and come up with something entirely different.
Yeah. Well, I think that people who are connected to that part of history in the way I am, in a way that's personal because I'm from here, but not really personal because I'm not connected to those characters in any personal way. I think that the book probably works very well. I know that there are direct descendants of the Peytons still living in Newfoundland, and I've heard through the grapevine that they're not particularly pleased about the book.
Hmm.
But I think for them, too, it's partly they're very defensive about the Peytons' reputation, and particularly John Peyton Jr.'s reputation, because in Newfoundland, I think there's been a tendency to confuse the two men, the father and son, so that John Peyton Jr. has been seen as a great Indian killer as well, just people not getting the difference between the senior and junior. So I think they've been fairly active in trying to rehabilitate his reputation, and aren't always, and I think are understandably a bit defensive when someone else comes in and starts writing a story that involves those men somehow.
When did the change of heart begin, you think? When did it become important for a person's reputation to be rehabilitated?
Well, I think it really depends on whose reputation, in whose eyes mm-hmm. you cared about your reputation. Because I think even at the time, there was a lot of public sympathy for the Beothuk, especially in official circles. And in fact, I think there were some settlers who felt that in a court of law, for example, if someone was accused of killing a Beothuk, then they were going to be convicted regardless of what the facts were, because they saw some sort of bias in favor of the Beothuk at the time. I think that's probably overstated, but I do think that there were, for example, people who believed that the English and the French and the Spanish could not just show up and claim whatever land they wanted because it belonged to the Beothuk, who lived there before the Europeans arrived, which I had always thought of as a 20th century idea. But those opinions were around at the time.
Yeah, I wonder, there's a pair of characters in the book that I found quite interesting, Riley and his wife Annie Boss.
Right.
They would have seen things differently, I think.
Right. Yeah, Annie Boss is a Mi'kmaq woman who, the idea for her as a character came from a couple of other historical figures that I read about. There were a small group of Mi'kmaq Indians who are primarily based in Nova Scotia, but there were a small group who lived in Newfoundland as well. And their relationship to the Beothuk was a very ambivalent one, as well as the whites' relationship with the Beothuk, it seems. But there were reports of groups of Mi'kmaq who were very sympathetic to the plight of the Beothuk. And that's where Annie came from for me. And we see through the novel that her sense of what's happening to the Beothuk and her sympathy for them is one of the strongest notes in the book in that direction. And her husband, Joseph Riley, who's an Irish thief, who's been exiled in Newfoundland, I think his position as kind of a marginalized character as well leads him to have a sympathy for the Beothuk that a lot of the other European settlers did not have.
Mm-hmm. Joseph Riley is an Irishman who, he and his family lived in England, and he was caught, and he was charged with something he didn't do, although he was guilty of stealing something else, but
right.
he was caught and branded,
that's
a
right.
thief, and then exiled to the colonies.
Right. And that's, I remember when I was doing the research for the novel, that one detail of how thieves weren't always sent to jail, they would have a T branded onto their hands. I just found that detail it was an aside in another book in which the person writing the book was just trying to indicate why people would choose to live in Newfoundland at the time, which was I thought, a very good question. Like, life in Newfoundland at the time was really, really harsh. But in this particular book, the woman writing it was just pointing out that life in England and Ireland and Scotland at the time in some ways was worse, and that it was that if you were poor in England, for example, Newfoundland could look pretty good because at least you would own your own piece of land and work for yourself pretty much, and that's why a lot of the people came over. But she also gave the example of how arbitrary the justice system in Britain was and how often criminals were branded with this T. And as soon as I read that detail, I knew that I would have a thief in the novel who was branded with this T. I wasn't sure what part he would play, but that's where Riley came from originally, just that one aside.
Yeah, it's an interesting character. That is where River Thieves, the first time we see the word, appears,
right,
when we meet him.
That's right. His father is a lumper on the East India ships on the Thames, but his real job is stealing from the East India ships. And there was a whole sort of underground society of river thieves who made their living by, at night, paying off the people who watched the ships or cutting the moorings of those ships so they floated into a more secretive location and just stealing the cargoes. So stealing indigo and tea and coffee and those sorts of things and then selling them to fences. And so Riley grows up in a family of river thieves. Yeah.
River pirate.
River pirates, yeah.
Also, I was struck in the book by the description of the spectacle, the grand spectacle, the march to the gallows was.
Right. Yeah, because I wanted Riley in the book, I had to do quite a bit of research about the justice system in Britain at the time, and was really struck by the brutality of it. In fact, the laws at the time were known as the Bloody Code, and at that time, hanging was sort of the punishment for just about any offense, including something as minor as, like, stealing candlesticks. The hangings ended up being huge public spectacles. And I wanted to get that into the novel just because I thought it was so striking, of the convicts, the condemned convicts being ferried through the streets of London with thousands upon thousands of people lining the streets. And there's a sense of it almost being a celebratory thing somehow, how it would wend its way through the streets and stop at alehouses so the convicts could drink. They would bring out free drinks for them to drink on their way. And then the tens of thousands of people who would show up where the hanging would take place to watch that spectacle.
It was almost like they were on a march to sainthood.
Yeah, there were. I think there probably was a sense for certain sectors of the people who came to watch that they were kind of folk heroes somehow, because they would often. Most of the people ended up hanging, of course, were poor people, and most of the people who turned out to watch were also people from poorer parts of London. And I think that there was a real sense of camaraderie with them, and not there. I don't think there was a separation between the audience and the people being hanged, in the same way that I think I would have thought before I started doing the research.
Michael Crummy is our guest this afternoon. He's a writer. He's a poet, short story writer. River Thieves is his first novel. It was published to great acclaim last year in Canada. The book's now available in the U.S. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the conversation with a telephone call. The number's in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. We haven't talked much about Cassie yet.
She's
a great character.
Yeah, she's my favorite character in the book. And I think probably in some ways the central character. She's kind of the linchpin of the novel for me. One of the things, I didn't really know much of what I was doing when I started writing this book, and I think I was flying blind through it in a lot of ways. But I knew when I started out that I didn't really want to write a novel about the Beothuk Indians. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that I didn't ever want to feel like I was speaking on their behalf somehow. But secondly, we know so little about them that I felt it would be impossible to write a novel about them without being dishonest somehow. So in a lot of ways, they're in the novel almost as an absence. They're always sort of on the margin, mm-hmm. off in the wilderness somewhere. And so what I wanted to do when I was writing the novel was to cover some of the same emotional territory that the historical story of what happened to the Beothuk calls up in me, the sense of guilt and regret and shame that I feel when when I think about what happened to them. I wanted to cover that same emotional territory without writing about them directly. And the way that I tried to do that was by creating this character of Cassie. And I think in unfolding her story through the novel, I think the characters around her, and hopefully I think the reader as well, gets to cover some of that same territory, and in some ways her story reflects back to the story of what happened to the Beothuk, and those things mirror each other in some way.
Hmm. I would guess a woman like Cassie would be atypical in Newfoundland because of her education, but I wonder about her independence,
right.
Her ability to live in the wilderness. It seems to me that that's got to be a very useful thing to have going for you.
Yeah.
To what extent is Cassie typical or atypical?
Well, I think in terms of education, it's very, very atypical. At the time, almost no one who was from Newfoundland, who was born here, would have had any formal education at all. Some of the people who came from England would have had some, but often not, again, especially if they came from poorer communities. Cassie's education, of course, comes from her mother, who is the daughter of a minister. So she was sort of homeschooled by her mother. But in terms of her independence, I think probably fairly typical of women in Newfoundland at the time, and there would not have been many. But there are records of women who came over with their husbands and who, after their husbands died, they just took over their property and ran those enterprises in the same way that their neighbors, the men who would be their neighbors, would run theirs. Incredibly strong and incredibly independent women. And so they sort of became my model for the kind of stoic independence that Cassie exhibits throughout the novel. Although the reason for her holding herself apart the way that she does is probably quite different from what it would have been for other women at the time.
Yeah. In Newfoundland history, are there stories of women like Cassie? Do women hold a solid place in the making of the country in its history?
Not in the official histories, no. I think it's much like the official histories of most of North America. It's sort of white men who show up more often than anything else. But I think more and more now, as people are looking to the stories underneath those official histories, it's becoming clear how huge a role women played in the building of this place. In a lot of communities, even in my father's generation, for example, there were many, many communities where the men left for the entire summer, and they took part in what was called the Labrador fishery. And in early May, they would sail down to the coast of Labrador, and they would be gone until September or October. So the women then ran the community entirely by themselves. So all the food that was grown for the winter was grown by the women. All of the social activities in the community were organized and run by women. Any crisis that came up in the community while the men were away were dealt with by the women. And I think that strain of independence and strength is something that you still see in the women here today. I lived away from Newfoundland for almost 14 years and had just moved back about a year and a half ago, and I think was really surprised to see I hope I'm not reading too much into it, but it did seem like women here were very different from women that I knew in other parts of Canada in terms of that sense of independence and strength.
Mm.
Yeah.
I wonder if there are many oral histories or diaries, journals out there in Newfoundland written by women, or the stories of women that are just now just waiting to be discovered and explored.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the further back you go, the less there is, of course,
mm-hmm.
and that's true
for men too.
For men as well, just because so many people in Newfoundland were uneducated, so there was very little written down, unfortunately. But there has been a lot of work done in the last 50 years, by people going out into communities to sit down with people to try and get those sorts of oral histories on paper. And so I do think that our sense of what Newfoundland was like 50 years ago and 100 years ago has changed a lot in the last little while based on those what we hear from those oral histories. Yeah.
Part of the richness of River Thieves for me lies in its detail and how it swings back and forth in time.
Right.
I have never even sat down to try to write a novel, but it seems to me that that's got to be a very difficult task, is to have the story sweep in and sweep out and sweep back over us. And the detail is filled in over time, and it's rich and woven into the story very masterfully.
Oh, thank you.
Was it difficult to write to do that? To keep track of where you were in the story and come back to it?
It was the hardest thing I've ever done, I think, in terms of writing. And I just saw Michael Ondaatje read it here in St. John's, and someone was asking him if he was working on a new book, and he said that he wasn't in a rush to get back into the fear and loathing that is writing a novel. And I really related to that. I think I spent a lot of the time while I was writing this book in a state of either panic or despair, just because there were so many different strands to the novel that I was trying to weave together, and was never sure until I finished whether or not they were weaving together or just were a mess. And also, the other really difficult thing about writing this book was I knew almost nothing about how people lived at the time. Those details that you talk about that make the texture of the book feel real, I had to learn them all as I went. So it felt like every time I sat down to write, I constantly came up against things I didn't know. So I didn't know what people wore or what their chairs would look like or how they heated their houses or what they ate or how they skinned a seal, for example. So I was constantly having to stop writing or writing past those things I didn't know and then having to go out and find those details and try to weave them into the book without choking a reader with them. So trying to get them in there without hitting people over the head, you know, to make them feel like, okay, this guy's writing an historical novel. I wanted it to feel like the details of these people's lives, the same as you would if I was writing a novel about St. John's in the year 2002. Mm-hmm. And it was really, because I had never done it before, I had no sense that I was being successful in doing it. So, I found that a really difficult thing. And I have to admit, I'm not in a big rush to get back into it either. But hopefully, I certainly don't feel the same sense of fear about it that I did 6 or 8 months ago. So hopefully I'll take another shot at it.
Well, I hope so. Although, you know, I can appreciate not wanting to go into a place of fear and loathing. On the other hand, the end result is very nice.
Well, I also think that part of not really knowing what I was doing and constantly feeling challenged by the book, I was pushed to be a better writer than I was, it feels like. So I think that would be part of the next book as well, I hope. And I think that if I don't feel like I'm being constantly pushed, then I'm probably not writing as well as I should be.
Mm. Part of the fun of the book is the richness in language. And I know that you drew on the Dictionary of Newfoundland English as a source.
Yeah, that's an amazing book. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
It's on the. I just looked it up today on the internet.
Right,
and it's there, complete. And I found it very fascinating.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, well, my question was before I started to look at the dictionary, I thought, well, in Newfoundland they speak English. How different is Newfoundland English from American English or the English that's spoken in the British Isles?
Right.
And apparently there's quite a number of words and phrases that are unique to Newfoundland.
Yeah, a very unique place. The dictionary itself is about 600 pages long, and because Newfoundland is an island and was very isolated, it did establish its own sort of dialect. And in fact, because the different parts of Newfoundland were isolated from each other, there are very different dialects and very different accents in different parts of the island. That's not as true now, of course, because of standardized schooling and television and those sorts of things. But even in my dad's time, that was very true. And I think, too, because there was very little schooling, people didn't have a sense that there were rules that had to be followed in speaking. And they were consequently incredibly imaginative in how they used the English language. And I wanted some of that richness in the way the characters speak, but also in the narrative of the book itself. And so I sat down and I read the dictionary from cover to cover.
Hmm.
And after I had a nearly complete draft of the novel, and as I was reading, words would just jump out, and I would know exactly where I was going to use them in the novel. And I just went back then and plugged them into those particular passages or conversations.
That sounds like you had some fun along the way.
I did. And one of the neatest things that happened, actually, was almost all of the things that I was reading in the dictionary, I thought I was unfamiliar with, and I thought I had never heard before. And then a month later or 3 months later, I would hear my dad using those exact phrases or words that I thought I'd never heard before.
Mm.
So for him and people of his generation, those words are still a part of their living vocabulary.
Mm. We're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure.
Michael Crummie has been our guest this afternoon. Look for his book, River Thieves, a novel. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin.